Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with you for the next hour talking about things going on in and around New York area, the country, the world. And also, I have a wonderful guest on my show today, Mary Berry. She is the daughter of Wendell Berry and the executive director of the Berry Center. And I'll have her on telling us what the work of the Berry Center is and what she's doing. And, of course, I'll be sharing a recipe with you. So sit down, relax, and let's spend the next hour together. First, some of the upcoming events in and around the New York area. This Friday, tomorrow, there are two things going on. There's the first annual Save Long Island Forum, which is at the Upski Long Island Hotel, and there's a bunch of different speakers that are there. It starts Friday and it goes through Sunday. So you can go onto the SaveLongIslandForum.com website and find out everybody who's going to be there. Tomorrow evening is also the kickoff party for the 7th annual Winterfest. The kickoff party starts tomorrow, but the festival actually goes through March. And this kickoff party will take place at the Suffolk Theater. And tickets are only $20 in advance, $25 at the door. And so it sounds like a good, fun thing. It's going to be wine and food and music just to get, to kick off this festival. And the festival is, all the vineyards out on the East End and the North Fork opening their doors up throughout the winter with live music and food for a full month. So it's really actually more than a month, 6 weeks I think it goes for, from February 8th through March 16th. So it's really a lot of things going on out on the East End if you're in this area. Next weekend is the NOFA New York's Winter Conference. It's the 32nd Annual Organic Farming and Gardening Conference, and that takes place every year in Saratoga Springs at the Saratoga Hilton. And if you register, you can register online. I think you can also go just for the day and register at the door. But it's really great if you make plans to go up, make plans with other people, and it's a wonderful networking opportunity to meet other farmers and to just, brainstorm. And it's social as well. There's movies, there's dancing. It's lots of fun. January 25th and 26th, there's an organic beekeeping class in Brooklyn that's being hosted by Honeybee Lives. The Long Island Beekeepers Club also has ongoing bee classes. You can go to the Long Island Beekeepers Club website to find out their schedule. But all of these classes are going on right now because this is the time you need to be thinking about ordering bees if you want to get some beehives going. So we started two beehives this past summer, and it's been really a wonderful experience. We keep checking on them throughout the winter to make sure that they're still humming, and they are. That's very exciting. February 3rd, Slow Wine USA Tour is in New York City. And Slow Food is having an evening. They're going to show offer the book, Slow Wine USA. And it's a slow wine guide, and it costs $25 to get in. There's going to be over 70 different wines represented, as well as some food to go along with it. So that's from 6 to 8:30 at 125 West 18th Street. And I have information about that on my website at iegreen.com, or you can go to Slow Food New York City's website to find out about that. February 16th, Slow Food Hunting is having a great event. It's called the Food and Film Feast, and we are going to be pairing food with the documentary films that we're showing. So most of the films are shorts. The longest one's 30 minutes. Most of them are like 5 minutes. And they're really sweet, lovely films. And we picked the films so that we could create a really wonderful gourmet dinner for you. So it starts with an appetizer, then it moves on to a main course, a pasta dish, a dessert dish, and some other things in between. But there's five different courses with six different films. So it's really going to be a fun evening. And that is on February 16th at 6:30. It will all be done in the cafe at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. So you will not be in the theater. You'll be sitting at tables. So after each movie, the members of Slow Food Huntington will serve all the guests at their tables, and it should be really nice. February 13th, Edible Manhattan presents the fourth annual Good Spirits. And that's another evening of drinking and eating. That's February 13th from 6 to 9. Again, you can find out about that at Edible Manhattan's website. On January 26th is the New York Chili Fest. That's from 7 to 9 at the Chelsea Market. And Just Foods Conference is coming up as well. That's April 5th and 6th from 8 to 5 p.m. And that this year is taking place up at Columbia's Teachers College. So that's a really, you know, a fun place to have the workshops. I've gone to many workshops up there. And the Just Food Conference has so many different things going on. It's a two-day event. And there's, you know, food professionals, entrepreneurs, there's a whole job-seeking day where people offering jobs get paired up with people looking for jobs. There's CSAs there, there's community organizers. So there's a lot of wonderful things that go on at the conference. So if you can make it, that's definitely something you don't want to miss. And then I almost forgot to mention TEDx Manhattan is coming up. And that is... Where is that? TEDx Manhattan is on March 1st at the Time Center, and it's The Way We Eat. And it's TEDx all about food, and so that's a really wonderful event as well. So tickets are on sale for that now, and you can register online. So go to TEDx Manhattan to find out more information about that. So now, some of the things going on that I really want to make you all aware of, that is, one is very exciting, and that's that the Maine governor, Paul LePage, just passed the second law in this country for the requiring of labeling of genetically modified foods. And that's really great. And of course, it's contingent on other states doing the same, just like Connecticut was the other state that passed this law. And there's bills in New York State that are waiting to see if they get passed for genetically modified labeling. And we are one of the only countries right now that does not have labeling of genetically modified ingredients. And it's really so crucial that we get labeling mandatory, because we need transparency in the foods we eat. We need to know what we're eating. And the way it is set up right now is that right now in Congress, there has been a bill proposed that will allow anybody to do voluntary labeling, but it will restrict and create a law that will prevent mandatory labeling in the whole country. And that's, you know, a bill that's been proposed by the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Of course, has lots of support from food manufacturers. And we really don't want to let that happen. So I really want to celebrate Maine for their new law, and encourage all of you, anytime you have an opportunity to sign a petition or to write a letter to support labeling. It's really, really so important. Another thing that was disturbing that we discovered this week is that, it came out through Greenpeace that there are so many chemicals in clothing. And this article is mostly geared to children's clothing. But it's something we just don't normally think about. You know, you buy clothes for your kids and you just think that they're, you know, fine, even if you buy organic clothes. But the problem is there's a lot of chemicals that are used in the manufacturing of these clothes, and they remain on the clothes when you buy them. And so Greenpeace has really been pushing to try to raise awareness about that. And some brands, I know Zara, H&M, they've actually made a commitment to try to clean up their products and remove some of these hazardous chemicals. But we need to do more. So there's petitions going around for that as well, to sign a petition to let, you know, you can go on Greenpeace's website to find out more about this. And it's just something I wanted to make you aware of, because, you know, it's something we don't think about, just like chemicals that are in our healthcare products and in our shampoos and facial creams. All this stuff is, you know, being put into products, and we just don't think about it. And we all need to start thinking about it. We need to take these matters into our own hands to protect ourselves, because the contamination that we are all susceptible to through environmental, our environmental surroundings is really dramatic. So I just want you to think about that. And then also, there is heavy crude oil risks in the Hudson that I want you to know about. You know, there was that leak down in Virginia of chemicals into the water, and all these people could not drink their water. Well, that can happen anywhere, and we all need to, again, put our, let our voices be heard and take action. There's so many issues, and I know it's really hard, and we all are so busy, but we need to be active. We need to be active citizens working for change. And there is a petition on my website that you can sign to help protect the Hudson River. Also, last week I had a wonderful guest on, and we talked about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And that's right now is being pushed through Congress. They're trying to get it pushed through fast track. And what that means is that it will give President Obama the power to make decisions on our behalf without it being really discussed in Congress. And this treaty, people describe it as NAFTA on steroids, this treaty will jeopardize so many different things, and I'm mostly concerned with our food, obviously. It will make it so that other countries cannot have genetically modified or have laws preventing genetically modified ingredients, because that will be against the treaty. It will take jobs away from this country and bring them over to other countries where they can exploit the workers and have work in unsafe working conditions. And it's just a really bad thing, and it's something that you can learn more about also on my website and sign a petition there as well. And now I want to share a recipe with you. I posted a picture of my breakfast last week, which was scrambled tofu with vegetables, and I got so many requests for the recipe. So that's the recipe I'm going to share with you today. It's super simple, very delicious, and it's, you know, one of those mornings when you want to sit down and you feel like eggs, but you don't want to eat eggs. This is a great, great substitute. Scrambled tofu with vegetables, and as in all of my recipes, it's flexible with what vegetables you have in hand in your refrigerator. So if you don't have a lot of vegetables, you can even do it just with onions. But, you know, I like to expand the tofu and have a lot of vegetables. So this is my recipe. One large onion chopped, two small potatoes cut into quarters, one teaspoon minced garlic, one carrot chopped, one parsnip chopped, 1.5 cups of broccoli florets, and I cut them pretty small so they cook quickly and they're really just bite-sized. 1/2 red pepper chopped, 1 zucchini diced, 1/2 a block of extra firm tofu that I press between 2 towels to try to remove as much water as possible. Olive oil, 1.5 teaspoons, I'm sorry, just 1/2 teaspoon of turmeric, 1/2 tablespoon of tamari, salt and pepper to taste, 1 tablespoon chopped dill, and 2 tablespoons chopped parsley. If you have other herbs, you can use other herbs. Feel free to swap those out for different flavor experiences. And you're going to start, I boiled the potatoes. If you have leftover potatoes, great, you can use leftover potatoes. But the potatoes will take a little longer to saute, so I give them a head start by throwing them into a little pot of water to boil for a few minutes while I start sauteing the other vegetables. So I take out a heavy, large skillet, and I saute the onion, the carrots, and the parsnips in a little olive oil until they're soft, about 5-10 minutes. And you keep stirring so they don't start to burn. Then add the peppers, the zucchini, the broccoli, and the garlic, and continue cooking for about 5 more minutes. Take the potatoes out of the boiling water and cut them up so they're bite-sized pieces, and put them into the pan and mix them up with the other vegetables. Then take the tofu and you just crumble the tofu right into the sautéed vegetables. Add the spices, the turmeric, the tamari, the salt, and pepper, and cook for 5 more minutes, and then taste it and adjust the spices. If you need more salt and pepper, or you want more tamari, you can do that. The turmeric is mostly there for color, but if you want to taste it a little bit more, you can add some more flavoring with that. And then add the parsley and the dill, and that's it. Super easy, quick, and you know, you can serve it with the toast, with a bagel, with crackers, whatever, or by itself. Just serve it, you can serve it with a little rice if you'd like. So that's my recipe. As always, if you have comments about the recipe or anything, please feel free to post them on my website at ieatgreen.com. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Mary Berry. Mary Berry is the executive director of the Berry Center, which was established to continue the Berry family's work in both culture and agriculture by working on issues of farmer education, consumer education, land use, agricultural policy, and urban and rural connectedness. And Mary started this with her brother, Den, and they were raised by their parents, Wendell and Tanya Berry, in Kentucky. And she's been farming her whole adult life there in Kentucky. And Mary, are you with me?
I am.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I feel so much smarter now after listening to all your announcements, not to mention starving to death.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know what? I get that every week from my guest.
Well, it all sounded so good.
I should tell everybody to eat before they come on.
Well, I mean, you shouldn't have to eat at 10:15 in the morning.
Right. Well, if you haven't had breakfast yet, but anyway.
I have.
Good. Okay. So save that for lunch then.
I will.
So can you share with us first, when did you start the Berry Center, and what was your inspiration behind starting the Berry Center?
The Berry Center has, let's see, I guess that at this point I started thinking about the Berry Center about 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what really made me think that I was going to need to start something called the Berry Center was the fact that at roughly the same time I was voted on to a grassroots, the board of a grassroots organization here in Kentucky, at the same time I was appointed a federal appointment to a state board called the Farm Service Agency, which is a big USDA program. My first brush with anything USDA. But it was interesting to juxtapose the two sides of agriculture, the small farm entrepreneurial agriculture that CFA has been representing, and then, of course, the USDA commodity agriculture. But the interesting thing to me was that how little either board knew about what was going on in agriculture in a place like I'm from. Mm-hmm. Henry County, Kentucky is an agricultural county, and it's falling apart. It's the agrarian culture and economy that we lived in is pretty much decimated, and it's been replaced by commodity agriculture, and the two boards just really were not aware of what was going on. And I thought at that point, well, I better take my place in this somewhere and in this fight that, or this what, this effort that my family's been involved with for about 100 years, to advocate for small farmers and small communities. So I went to my father and I said, Daddy, if people had been listening to you all this time, we'd be in better shape. We need to be talking about these things, about what's going on in places like Henry County. We need to work on access to capital and land use and education, etc. And he said, it sounds like you're starting a center. And I said, I think I am. And he said, do it. Mm-hmm. He, in fact, said, you're talking about institutionalizing my work, and it needs to be done. And, of course, it's not, as he would tell you quickly, it's not just his work. It's the agrarian thought that's been alive, kind of a thread of it has been alive always. And Daddy has just picked it up and continued it. So we're picking it up from Daddy and continuing it. But it's not just my father. It's also my father, my uncle, and my grandfather. So that is the long answer to your short question.
Uh-huh. So you're really acting as almost a liaison or a bridge between the two worlds of the small farmer and the USDA.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that we are acting as, hoping to act as a bridge between the small farmer entrepreneurial farm market, CSA, et cetera, world, and what my friend Fred Kerseman, a great advocate for sustainable agriculture, calls farmers in the middle. Farmers in the middle are the farmers that we're losing the most of, and they're the farmers that own the most land. And they're making, I think, the agricultural census defines them as farmers making between $50,000 and $500,000 a year. So it's a huge spread. Uh-huh. But those are the farmers that I'm absolutely for any small farmer, any entrepreneurial effort, I'm for it all. But the farmers in the middle have kind of been left out of this and out of this effort. And the divide between them and this small local agriculture is almost complete. It's as complete as any political divide in our country. So I'd say that, yes, I'm trying to bridge a gap. The gap between farmers and USDA is... I don't know what we can do about that. We can talk about that a little if you'd like, but mm-hmm. It's just such terrible split,
mm-hmm.
ruinous split.
Right. And is there any, what are the efforts going on trying to help farmers that were in the middle transition to be more of the sustainable farmer that could stay alive through CSAs and organic farmers markets and things like that?
Well, I don't think that there is, and I will welcome any news from any listener who knows of efforts going on for that, for those farmers. I don't think there is a lot. And in my thinking about these issues now for some 30 years plus, I think at this point we've got to think about an economy for those farmers. An economy they can function in. Excuse me?
Which farmers? The middle farmers or the...
Yes, the farmers in the middle. Entrepreneurial farmers are by definition taking care of their own market. Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful and needs to happen, and they've led the way. But they're in my area, and what I see across the country are a lot of farmers who, while maybe very good farmers, maybe very good land users, maybe all kinds of good things, but they are not necessarily entrepreneurial. And what we're asking them to do is take care of everything, raise it, market it, distribute it, absolutely every part of their business they have to take care of. I think as a culture, we need to get to the point that we value people who understand land use enough to make sure there's a food system they can actually function in. My husband started the first CSA in Kentucky and paid off a farm at 13% interest doing it. But as he says, it's in many ways a young person's game. So do we want, we're both 55 now, do we want 55-year-old farmers to not have a place to move into some kind of food production that is not requiring the kind of labor that a CSA or a farm market requires? I think that we want to keep them farming. So anyway, so to that point, I'm working on the best example of farm policy that we've got in our history, and that is the Burley Tobacco Program. It has been lost, I think, because of the stigma of tobacco. That program has been over for 10 years. It was not a subsidy. It was a price support. It kept farmers out of a ruinous boom and bust economy. It protected them from overproduction, and it protected the land from overproduction. So we certainly don't.
Can you tell us? I think most of us don't know what that is, the Burley Tobacco. What was it?
It was called the Burley Tobacco Program, and it's the reason that Kentucky has 84,000 small farms today. My grandfather wrote the piece of the Burley Tobacco Program that actually worked for 65 years, and we need to, let me say quickly again, I am not talking about tobacco. I am in no way interested in a dangerous crop. I am interested in the policy that protected diversified farmers in our area. So the Burley Tobacco Program was in place. It started as a hemp program, actually, and it moved to Burley Tobacco, and it just matched up a market, a supply, and a demand. And as I said, protected farmers from overproduction, which I think this local food movement has got to think about. Farmers, overproduction is death to farmers. It's bankruptcy. So we've got to think about that. And I think it's time to think again about parity. In the sense that we need to think about farmers' whole lives. What does it take? What will it take to encourage farmers to raise good food sustainably for a local market? What do they need? What are the costs associated, and so on? And I do think that the people on our side of this effort often aren't thinking enough about that. So the Burley Tobacco Program thought about all of those things, and it put in place an economy that supported the culture of small rural places. In my lifetime, I have seen Henry County change from a pretty healthy farm economy, a lot of very diversified farms. We need to remember at this point that tobacco was not a specialty crop, or farmers were not specialists. They were diversified. The tobacco program allowed for 4 or 5 acres of a crop to be raised on a farm. You had only an allotment. You could not raise more. So people made farm payments based on their tobacco crop, but they were also raising fruits, vegetables, forage crops, some grain crops. There was a good deal of subsistence farming going on, which, by the way, my father says agriculture started going the wrong way when farmers stopped growing for their own subsistence. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at that. I've put together a group of people who know a good deal more than I do about policy work to take the tobacco program and see if we can now apply it to everything that a farmer can produce, from timber to tomatoes. So we'll see what happens. Nobody's told me we can't do it. They've just told us it'll take a while and it'll be hard.
Right.
But most things are.
At this point, tobacco just has such a,
such a nasty connotation because mm-hmm. people associate it, of course, with cigarettes. And mm-hmm. so you might want to rename the rename the program.
Well, we of course will rename the program.
Yeah.
But I think that it seemed to me that in the last couple of years, when I've talked about this places, that people see now. We've gone so, we are now expecting about, you know, somewhere around 1% of the population to supply sustainable local food to urban people. First of all, only 16% of the countryside or this country live in rural places. So we've got a depopulated countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, I'm sure some of your listeners know about a place called the Land Institute in Kansas, run by Wes Jackson, who is working on perennial grain crops. But Wes has an idea about eyes to acres, which is exactly right. To farm well, if this country's going to be farmed well, we've got to have a lot of eyes to acres. We've got have to have a lot of people on the land farming it well. And I just don't think that's going to happen if we stick to an entrepreneurial, it's not a system, an entrepreneurial agriculture. We've got to make some kind of policy that farmers can function in, and we just haven't done it, haven't even thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worth thinking about.
So what you mean by that is that we need farmers that are also growing large quantities, not just farmers growing for their small local CSA?
Well, we need a way that farmers who are now raising hundreds and hundreds of acres of corn and soybeans to begin to move toward a better agriculture. And I don't think we're going to get them to do it without telling them, offering them some way to make a living doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. At this point, there is no way. You know, I can tell you too many stories about farmers in our area getting into the wholesale vegetable market. Everybody's, say, tomatoes come in at the same time, the price plummets, and the farmers make no money. And there's no, you know, corn and subsidized crops have a whole culture around them that is ruinous,
mm-hmm.
but it's possible to make a living doing it. We've got to make a sustainable farming economically viable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the reason for, a reason for government, a reason for decent policy.
Right. Well, now the policy, you know, in the Farm Bill is to keep subsidizing and to raise more subsidies for these, you know, crops of soybean, corn, wheat, mm-hmm. cotton. And, I mean, I always find it so funny that the food we eat are called specialty crops. I would think the other food crops should be specialty crops. The food we eat are the foods we need.
Well, at the moment, food is plentiful, so it's the last thing on our minds. If food becomes not so plentiful, which is pretty much bound to happen if we keep going this way, then it'll be the first thing on anybody's mind, on everybody's minds. And, our leaders are failing us. They really are. They're not looking at this and taking up their role as teachers and, protectors. They're just simply failing. So,
right.
So all these grassroots efforts are a great reason to hope, and it's about our only reason at the moment.
Right.
So I want to say back to your point about tobacco, and I'm not going to argue it. I have no interest in tobacco, but with the end of the tobacco program, because there was nothing else, there was no other economy offered or thought about, the farmers in our country have gone toward money, the only money there is, which has been still in tobacco, but now they're contracting directly with the company. So farmers that used to raise 4 or 5 acres of tobacco plus and had diversified, healthier farms are now raising hundreds of acres of tobacco. tobacco with migrant labor.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that farmers are doing in our area is plowing up our rolling countryside, getting rid of fences to raise corn and soybeans. They're two-crop farmers. There are fewer and fewer of them farming more and more acreage, and it is a disaster. The erosion here, the topsoil erosion, is criminal, and no one's talking about it. And it's because farmers have gone toward the only way to make a farm payment.
Mm-hmm.
You can't blame them.
Yeah, no, I don't blame them. Mm-hmm. You know, at times I found myself at odds with, you know, the Long Island Farm Bureau here because, you know, the
effect.
Right. Because, you know, to them, sustainable means that the farmer doesn't go out of business. And mm-hmm. I so appreciate that. And I, you know, I know farmers were kind of like caught in the middle. They were sold these mm-hmm. GMO seeds and these crops, and they were sold.
Well, they've
this
been encouraged
system.
To do what they're doing by land-grant universities and government policy.
Of course. And so they really, you know, they were led down a dark path not knowing
yes, they
it
were.
And then left there. And
exactly.
And it's really, it's so not their fault. And I don't think anybody who's an organic person or sustainable person, you know, is into sustainability, thinks of the farmer as the bad person. We mm-hmm. we see them as the victim in a sense.
Well, I think that that's truer now than it was a couple of years ago. I think people are realizing that we're all implicit in what's going on. None of us are innocent of what this economy, this ruinous economy, has done to the source of our survival. So I think people know more and more. I mean, it's certainly encouraging to me when I travel and speak a good deal, and it seems to me in the last couple of years that the questions that I get or my father get are better and better and better. They're just not so... Well, sometimes they were just silly, and it's not so silly anymore. People are educating themselves, and that's very encouraging. And as you know, when I was thinking when you were reading through your announcements, I was thinking how many opportunities for us to be educated citizens now. There's mm-hmm. so many ways to figure out what's going on and to take some part in fixing what we see as wrong, and it's our duty. I mean, it's our pleasure. Leading an examined life is a good deal more interesting than leading a half-asleep one.
You're so right.
Anyway.
I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I agree with you, and yet it's so frustrating because there's so many times where there is such apathy, and people are, you know, stay in their little bubbles and don't do what they can or don't do anything, you know, just, you know, their life is okay, and, you know, mm-hmm. for the remaining of their life, they'll be okay, and they're not thinking mm-hmm. for the generations beyond them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is exactly why I think we need decent policy, because we're not going to convince everybody. And so if we have decent policy, and I'm going to use Kentucky as an example because it's what I know best, Louisville has become a really big market for locally produced food. And the citizenry of Louisville has pushed hard. So now big food distributors are looking for local food. I just spent 2 days at a meeting with Sodexo and Cisco and some other big food distributors who are at the table now. And mm-hmm. they're looking for more product. There's not enough product.
Right.
And
well,
so
also,
I'm hoping at, you know, but it's probably when I'm dead, but I'm hoping that at some point people won't have to make decisions all the time. When people go into their grocery stores in Louisville, Kentucky, let's say 20 years from now, I hope that when broccoli's in season in Kentucky, that's what's on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
And farmers are making a fair price, not a farmer's market top price, but certainly not a cheap price that'll run them out of business.
Right.
Right. Because we won't, as a, again, we will not convince everybody. And, you know, evangelism is so exhausting and boring.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I think this policy issue has got to be thought of now.
Well, I agree with you. Mary, we're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to, talk to you a little bit about some of the policies that you see that you're trying to introduce and see where that can go. So we'll be right back. Everyone, I'm talking with Mary Berry from the Berry Center in Kentucky, and I'm Bhavani from IE Green. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here today with Mary Berry from the Berry Institute in Kentucky, and we're talking about food policy and what things need to be done to make our farm bill more sustainable and take into consideration the lives and well-being of farmers. Mary, are you with me?
Yes.
Great. So, they're still debating this farm policy. I've talked about it so many times over the last couple of years as we kept thinking it's, pending. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. Where is the farm bill at right now? And how do you see getting some of these policies that you're talking about into the farm bill?
Frankly, I don't.
Oh, don't say that.
Frankly, I think this is a local market. This is local work at the moment. I think that we can affect something in Kentucky. I think we can. We have a very good mayor in Louisville, Kentucky, named Greg Fisher, who has us on his mind, who referred to his first 4 years in the mayor's office as four growing seasons. He keeps pushing for more and more local food. He's put money in it and people in good places to support it. And I think we can do something in our area. The USDA, the huge juggernaut that all of that is, I think people should do the best they can. I think they should find places to write their congressman or do whatever they can, but it is so entrenched and so difficult to deal with that I think it has to be gone around for a while, and I think that it will be influenced more that way than trying to come straight at it. That said, there is something called the 50-year farm bill that is coming out of the aforementioned Land Institute that I said is run by Wes Jackson. He, my father, Wendell Berry, and Fred Kirschman worked on something of a 50-year farm bill that is getting some traction. It's being paid attention to. And in to describe it briefly, in 50 years, it shifts our agriculture from 80% annual and 20% perennial to 80% perennial and 20% annual. If that could be done, it would take care of a good deal of, or go a long way in taking care of a good deal of what we're worrying about now. In a state like ours, I would say in a state like yours, it's very applicable. A lot of our good agriculture is perennial now. Forests, permanent pasture, forage crops, hay crops, etc. So that, if your listeners would like to read it, they can go to the Land Institute website and find it. Everybody ought to call their senators, representatives' attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
My father and Wes and Fred have been to Washington several times, and I expect will be several more to talk about it. And it's getting some traction. So there's something in place that people can support,
mm-hmm.
advocate for.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
It'll be a while.
The Farm Bill, like you said, is so entrenched, and it's, you know, I mean, public opinion has no bearing on what decisions they make.
As far as I'm concerned, politicians have no bearing on what's going to happen to it. The fact is, as far as I'm concerned, that agriculture has gone around politics, it's gone around the land-grant universities, and it's run by corporations.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and the Farm
now.
Bill will suit the corporations. And I think that it ought to be, this is not an excuse for apathy, but it's a good reason to find what's going on locally that you can support and help and be active in and do it.
Right.
Because I think that will change things. I think that the grassroots efforts that we see everywhere, I think things are being changed. My father
mm-hmm.
says when he wrote one of his books called The Unsettling of America, it was published in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, it was about what's wrong with our agriculture. At that point, he said he had four allies besides his family. Now he says everywhere you go, people are working on these problems. I think we are actually going to see a local food movement become cultural change,
mm-hmm.
and that will change everything.
Right.
I really believe that. What worries me, of course, is how long it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
there's
I'm
no
with
point.
You. I believe there's change happening, and I also mm-hmm. believe, you know, doing things on the local, in your local areas where you can really have the greatest impact for now.
I absolutely agree with you.
And, so before we run out of time, one thing I know you're doing locally that's really exciting is this partnering you're doing with St. Catherine's College.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share that with everyone, what that program is and what's going on there?
Yes. This is the first year of the Berry Center's agricultural program at a little college called St. Catherine in pretty much the dead center of Kentucky. It's a Dominican college. It's founded by Dominican nuns who have been fighting for good things for a long time now. I actually spent a couple of summers ago looking at colleges all over the place to find a place to put this four-year program, and people were very nice to me, and I didn't talk to a school that wasn't interested in doing something like I was talking about. I went to St. Catherine because first of all, they have a 700-acre farm that the nuns have been taking care of since something like 1826. Excuse me?
Do they do it organically?
Right now, yes. They do vegetable production organically, and there's beef production going on, it's already feeding the school to some extent. So I felt like to take the Berry Center program and tie it to something already going on would strengthen both things.
Mm-hmm.
So we hired a woman named Leah Bands to run the program. The first class of kids started last fall. One of whom is my nephew, Marshall Berry, who spent his life farming with his daddy, my brother, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've got is an education. It started with the idea of an education for homecoming. What would people need to know to farm well where they are? To again quote my friend Wes Jackson, he says that the primary major in colleges over the last 30 plus years has been upward mobility. Now it needs to be homecoming.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happened to our to the the financial picture in this country in the last few years tells us that that is true. So what I was looking for was a place to kind of be an alternative ag program to what's offered at our local land-grant university, which is the University of Kentucky. In my experience, which is getting longer all the time, the children of generational farmers in our area who want to farm go to the University of Kentucky. Those kids, generally speaking, do not end up farming. They end up farmer specialists of some kind. Or they do farm, and they farm in this boom and bust economy that we all think is ruining our countryside.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, as Daddy said, to try to turn UK is like trying to turn a battleship in the middle of the Kentucky River. It's just, it's about like dealing with the USDA.
Mm-hmm.
But so we went to a place that we could hit the ground running. We didn't have to turn anything. We could just begin to teach kids how to farm, or add to what they already knew about farming. We also were talking about rural leadership. We have very little of that left in our area, and we need to be cultivating it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interdisciplinary 4-year degree, so, you know, there's nothing, they're not just going to, they're going to learn how to be good citizens in a kind of classical way. And so I'm very excited about it. I mean, we've got a ways to go. The first class is enrolled, and, of course, the school needs money and needs support. But we're doing pretty well, and I'm proud of it. And I think we're going, it's one thing we need to do to change our culture. Our culture
right.
needs
How many
to
students
be
in the
agrarian.
Class? How many students in the class?
I think there's six at the Pomo. No. There are 10.
Mm, okay, so
you know,
well,
it's starting small, which it needs to
right.
do.
Uh-huh.
And but we've got some generational farm kids. We've got three students from other countries. It's pretty exciting.
Great.
Yeah. So, and we're also at the beginning of talks with a couple of schools of some reputation, talking about weaving agrarian thought through their curriculum so that the people who graduate from these Ivy League or very, what, I don't know how you describe them, impressive places,
mm-hmm.
the leaders of tomorrow understand that that our economy is as land-based now as it ever has been. Nothing's changed about that. So we need our leaders to be agrarians.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think these are the ways that we change the culture. The question, of course, remains, how fast can you change a culture? We'll see.
Right.
Don't
well,
know.
I'm so glad that you are doing that work there. I know in Lexington, there's a pretty active slow food movement there. I don't know if that's out by you as well.
Well, there's part of that. It's slow food bluegrass, so it's also Louisville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, so there's a good deal going on in Louisville.
Yeah, so, you know, it just seems like you'd be a good match together,
mm-hmm.
you know, working with the slow food movement, too, because they just have, you know, being a grassroots organization and really growing.
Mm-hmm.
There's more over, I don't know, over 200 chapters in the country. It's
mm-hmm.
a great way of also getting the word out there. But
well,
I
all of these efforts
you.
Need to be aligned better than they are. That's for sure.
For sure.
I mean, all
so
of these
we work
save
together.
Our. Excuse me.
Yeah. So we work together in catapulting
yes.
ourselves forward instead of everybody
yes.
on the same treadmill going nowhere.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. I talk about that all the time, so I'm with you there, Mary. But
mm-hmm.
I want to just thank you so much for the founding of the center and for your work and for your family's work. You know, it, like you said, you know, when your dad's book first came out, it was,
you know, really just started the conversation, and it's really catapulted into a whole new realm at this point, and it really needs, the conversation needs to keep happening.
Well,
so
I agree, and
you.
I thank you so much for your interest.
Thank you so much, and everybody, you've been listening to me, Bhavani Jaroff, at IE Green, talking with Mary Berry from the Berry Center. I'll be with you again next Thursday, and have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.